The Lone Rangers? That's original. How can you pluralize the Lone Ranger?
What's wrong with that?
Well, there's three of you. You're not exactly lone. Shouldn't you be the Three Rangers?
No idea what you're saying right now.
You lost me.
Hello and welcome to 50% Fresh, where we revisit movies that critics didn't love. We are two married dummies that'll be doing the revisiting. I'm Taylor.
Hi, I'm Mark.
And we like movies.
Here we are. Welcome. Thanks for checking us out. Our inaugural episode, I do believe. As Taylor was said, we are going to take a look at movies, I think... When you like a lot of movies, sometimes I think if you're aware of the critical consensus, a very common thing is going, what? Or maybe more importantly, screw you, that movie's good, I think. And so I think that might be one of the inspirations of this is I think we both have a lot of movies. I like to fight for something that maybe champions something a little bit, fly a flag for something that is maybe maligned. And sometimes things become punchlines. That movie, that piece of shit, that bomb or something, and I find people don't even like know anything about it.
Yeah, and... The first movie that we're going to talk about is Airheads, which when I looked up that movie and saw that it had a pitiful 29% on Rotten Tomatoes, I was very surprised. And so that's kind of the mission statement of what we're doing here. We're going to just revisit movies that were not certified fresh on Rotten Tomatoes. So anything like a 50% is generally where we're going to land, but you know, maybe a little bit above that, maybe a little bit below.
You get some wiggle room, I think, if you're technically gone, because Rotten Tomatoes will give you the nice looking tomato at 60% or above. So you can do 58, 59% and not, you know, you could have more than half of the critics supposedly thought you did a good job, but it's not enough to get that precious tomato. So yeah, we'll find those. But then also too, it's interesting to find the ones that have 0%, 2%, 4%. I can't promise we're going to like them all. You know what I mean? I think there's a positivity sort of threaded into this show of like, I'd rather champion something that deserves it than shit on something that I think should, that was made with heart. Right. But that said, we have some exciting things, I think, in the future, and we're gonna do it all from, I think, misunderstood, what we think are misunderstood movies, things like that. Like you said, with Airheads, too, and maybe just a quick background on us. We come from a comedy background. We met while we were both doing stand-up comedy, and comedy movies, genre movies, really, in general, a lot of the stuff we like are not known for their warm critical reception. And we're also not people, by the way, that are too hung up on critics. This is the most we'll probably ever talk about the critics, but I just think it's sort of the jumping-off point of all this is just like... A, senses of humor are obviously very subjective. Critics aren't, I don't think, known for theirs. You know what I mean?
No, and especially with comedies, it's like the critics are generally trying to crack jokes in their
That's
reviews.
That's a bad look. It's really, yeah.
Just got it reeks of trying to put yourself over, yeah. Which, you know.
Do you know what I always thought of, too, when, like, if you're like what I picture in my mind, a movie critic... The person that's watching a lot of the movies every week that come out, you know, not just some freelancer now that writes a Letterboxd review or something, no disrespect, but like, I work for this newspaper and I write all the reviews. It's like, did you feel like watching Airheads Wednesday at noon right before lunch or whatever? Because I was a kid that wanted to watch a movie with comedians making me laugh. Or do you know what I mean? And of course, I'm sure the critic's response would be, whoa, it should have been funnier or something. But I just mean...
Did you start watching this movie with your arms folded? Yeah, did you already make up your mind?
Right. And I think, of course, with things like comedy starring a bunch of knuckleheads and stuff like that, I think there's that a little bit.
Yeah, so maybe that's actually a good segue into just talking about the
movie
here.
Sure, absolutely.
So, as we mentioned, we are covering Airheads 1994, which, again, had a 29% on Rotten Tomatoes. It's three band members hoping for a big break, head to a radio station to play their demo tape, and wind up holding everyone hostage with toy guns filled with hot sauce when the DJ refuses to play them. So, It got generally pretty bad reviews. The critical consensus from Rotten Tomatoes, based on 38 reviews from places like the New York Times, Washington Post, Variety, was there's a biting satire that keeps threatening to burst out of the well-cast Airheads, but unfortunately, the end result lives down to its title in the most unfortunate ways. And I gotta say, most of the negative reviews I glanced at in preparation for this podcast, they love to make some kind of joke about the title of the movie.
That's exactly what we were just saying about, like, okay, if you don't like a movie, fair play, and you have a point to make about it, or you can state your opinion, the jokes didn't work for me, that's fine. I can't tell you that something's funny that you didn't think was funny, but when you're like, this movie is...
By Airheads for Airheads.
Exactly, right. You know who the real Airheads are. Everyone involved in the movie. Yeah, it's just, it's a little, It's like saying, this comedy stinks, also, this is how funny I am. So, there's maybe the takeaway is like, oh, and you didn't enjoy the jokes, eh? So,
yeah.
Maybe that's the thing, why comedies are a little like oil and water with critics sometimes.
Airheads didn't do super well. It had a budget of $11 million. It made $5.8 million gross box office. So, it did not make even half of its budget. But, directed by Michael Lehman, who directed the 1988 picture Heathers.
Which was, I think, everyone got really into and appreciated the satirical elements of that Heathers in a big way. I think it's a much, you know, and I like Heathers as much as anyone. But I just feel like, yeah, it's almost odd that Airheads got written off as like Airheads fart noise of just like, yeah, from the director of Heathers did like a rock and roll movie. Isn't that at least an intriguing, you know, there's stuff there.
Even on paper, the cast, if, listening to this list now,
listen to this.
It's got Brendan Fraser, Steve Buscemi, Adam Sandler, Joe Mantegna, Michael McKean, Ernie Hudson, Judd Nelson, Chris Farley, Michael Richards, Kramer, Harold Ramis, and David Arquette, to name a few.
So just to throw it out there, it's a great ensemble, held together at the core, a three-piece band. Just imagine, this movie's from 1994, we said, right? Released in August. So here we are. Some almost 30 years later, right? In 2022, if it was announced that Adam Sandler, Steve Buscemi, and Brendan Fraser were going to like anchor a film, that would be huge news. A lot of people would be excited. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's just such an airtight cast, watertight, that it's almost like easy to not notice because it is just like a goofy comedy, and I mean that in the best way, you know what I mean? But then the supporting cast, you get on, you have half of the Ghostbusters, you've got a member of Spinal Tap, you have, you know what I mean, Michael Richards, like sitcom royalty doing a largely physical subplot, like what a home run to get Kramer for that, you know. And yeah,
and
just, yeah.
I think it part of the reason why it's endeared itself to people like we were talking about before, we both write for the website The Hard Times, and I wouldn't be surprised at all to learn that most people that write for the site are fans of the movie Airheads.
Yeah, I wrote down, this is one of my big thoughts on the movie and what I like about it, and it's the sort of bigger mentality of it, but I like movies, comedies, and maybe this is something we try to do at The Hard Times a little bit too, is if you have the movie has an affection for the stupidity of rock and roll, right? Like it goes on the shelf with Spinal Tap and Wayne's World even too, I think too, of just like, there's ridiculous people, it's stupid, it's egotistical and whatever. And we think it's pretty cool. You know what I mean? I think there's a bit of that to it. And yeah. And I think it's with that, there's the love there. Like I like that, the movie, not to skip around, but the movie, treats these guys as pretty smart, even though they're also pretty dumb at the same time. Like there's a street smart. I like the scene. That's what I'm saying. The scene where they're making hostage demands that are so bizarre, they could plead insanity later. Like, that's a great idea. Like it kind of is a great idea, but then they also, don't know if Moby Dick was a book or a movie. You know what I mean?
They made a book out of it.
So yeah, exactly. So it's just that sort of thing of like the push and pull of like, of the rock and roll world. And so with that, it's not like, I wouldn't call it a full blown satire, but it pokes fun at all these things, you know, of, the people, the big bands, the little bands.
I think it's a lot more self-aware than people gave it credit for at the time.
Right.
It's like, they just, it's appropriate that there's a Beavis and Butthead cameo in the movie, because that's another thing I think was misunderstood. It's like, we're not celebrating being this dumb.
Right.
Like, they just think that like the people that watch Beavis and Butthead are as stupid as Beavis and Butthead are on the show.
Yeah.
So what do you guys want?
You guys are like, the Lone Rangers, right?
Yeah.
We saw you guys at the Wheel Well last month.
You fuck.
Yeah. Hey, come down here and say that, you punk.
Damn straight, you can kiss my ass.
I think, too, what makes this movie work, I think I was ramping up to it before, is that it pokes fun at rock and roll, it's satirical and everything else. I had the CD soundtrack to this movie as a kid, and it's got a great soundtrack. And the movie probably still works if it has a just fine soundtrack, but like, it's got a lot of really, really good stuff on it.
And that's sort of what lends it, I think, that's what I was getting at before, just like why people that are from that world have an affection for it, because they do make reference to Lemmy being God.
Mm-hmm.
But then also we see Lemmy in the movie.
Yeah.
In a cameo that's not really like, it's very memorable, but it's not like this is Lemmy from Motorhead. Jesus Christ. Like, maybe let's just wait.
Hold for dog here.
Yeah.
I was just wondering.
Come on, one more question. Hey, come on, cheers. One more.
Right. Who'd win in a wrestling match, Lemmy or God?
Lemmy.
God. Wrong, dickhead. Trick question. Lemmy is God.
Yeah! Oh, come on.
Then on the soundtrack, we've got Motorhead, Four Non Blondes, White Zombie, fucking the Lone Ranger's song is a Reagan Youth cover.
And it was cool to have the soundtrack CD where I could actually listen to that Lone Ranger song, because you hear it kind of in the movie, but you almost kind of wish you could hear it more. You know, you don't kind of hear it to the end, and it's sort of other stuff going on, but yeah.
And of course, the Ramones.
Yeah, so having the CD when I was young, I was a fan of this movie. I saw it in the theaters, as I recall, with my brother at the Saginaw 8 in Saginaw, Michigan, and got this CD soundtrack, which was the style at the time. And it was just like, you know, I was young enough that I didn't get that many CDs. So it actually introduced me to some like really, really cool stuff. Like if you put the comedy part of it aside, it's just like, oh yeah, like I don't know if I ever heard Motorhead before the Airhead soundtrack or Four Non Blondes' cover of I'm the One. And then years later, you find, oh, it's a Van Halen song. I didn't know that. I got there through the Airheads, you know, when you hear a cover first.
Which fucking rips, by the way. It's one of the rare occurrences of the cover being as good, if not arguably, better than.
Yeah. And I like that. That's one of my favorite. That one might be my favorite part, use of music in the movie. It's just a really fun montage. I'm the One. It's like they're kind of, it's when everything's in full party. They're, hey, we get free stuff, and everyone's showing up outside of the hostage situation to make it a big party.
Well, if we've taken over the radio station, we might as well play some good tunes.
Exactly right. Yeah. And that's even, you know, that's what I like. It's like, they take these quick little timeouts to poke fun at things like the music industry. And there's just like that quick exchange of like, hey, why don't you play any of this stuff? He's like, oh, how come it's not turning up the charts? Well, because you don't play them. You know, just like these quick truths about things that I really like that are tucked in there. But also too, the soundtrack, I didn't know until years later. First time I ever heard The Replacements, because that song was not on the CD. But that's like one of the best songs.
And it's so featured.
Movie. It's probably the other best musical moment. It's a movie full of musical moments. I should stop saying that. But it's a really great, somber moment. It's like, damn, what is this song? And it eluded me as a kid. But that's great. Also, too, Ice-T with Motorhead. That just rips, you know?
The intro song. And I think it was released as a single from the soundtrack, too. Yeah. So Born to Raise Hell, which was Motorhead, Ice-T, and Whitfield Crane.
Who I'm less familiar with, but they're all having fun. Good for them. We found on the DVD there is a music video that I think it's like, if I'm not wrong, it's people watching Airheads and then they like rip through the movie theater.
They have their own little Airheads.
They have their own, and by them I mean Motorhead with Ice-T and everything. Then they perform and the people in the movie theater are like, yeah, okay, I'll stay. I paid for a movie. I'm getting a concert. It's not so bad.
Seems like they have a good time.
Mm-hmm.
Just a neat little bit of trivia. So the radio station that they take over is KPPX, which is the location of that is the Fox Plaza in Los Angeles, but it's also Nakatomi Plaza in Die Hard.
Which is, you know, this is a thing that occurred to me watching this back. I guess it's kind of obvious, but I never thought about it this much. In like the Michael Richards character is a guy who is unseen by the band when they take their hostages with their plastic guns filled with pepper sauce. So he's kind of rogue and crawling through the vents, and he makes contact with the police outside. And I was thinking, so the kind of obvious thing, okay, we're having this whole little Die Hard subplot. It's pretty funny. And like that was huge. Die Hard was huge at the time. And also the thing was just like action movies. Everything was Die Hard on a blank, just like that style of movie. So perfect sense to have a guy crawling around. But what's funny to me is Michael Richards is just like, he's so, he's not all the way aware of what's going on. He doesn't know that these guys aren't complete lunatics. He doesn't know that the cop he's talking to outside is actually kind of a lunatic. You see him at he's got that great scene with Michael McKean where he's kind of getting pushed around and suckered into coming in on the weekend and stuff. And it's like, man, this poor guy really just gets taken for a ride that whole movie.
The unhinged cop you're referring to, I believe, is one Marshall Bell, who's in Total Recall.
Thank you. He's one of those. Yeah.
He's just got an intensity.
Yeah.
Anyways, the only little bit about I read the oral history that I think Consequence of Sound put out in a couple years ago, and the only little tidbit about Lemmy I could find, surprisingly, came from Marshall Bell, who said that he arrived on set and Lemmy was there, presumably to film his cameo, where he's editor of the school magazine.
Love it.
That he says that he was really excited to see Lemmy and ran up to him, and Lemmy turns around and says, "Dude, I loved you in Total Recall."
Oh, that's amazing.
Lemmy ruled.
Yeah.
No secret there.
Yeah! I was editor of the school magazine!
Yeah! He seems, you know, at the level of involvement, I'd be curious because he's got the movie, the single from the movie. That is also the movie opens prominently with. It has a really cool little title sequence and everything. It's hard not to just sit there and listen to Motorhead as the movie starts.
Yeah,
great tone.
It's got a really, really great opening credits.
By the way, this is a rock and roll movie that opens with Motorhead and ends with the Ramones. Like, that's an absolute home run. You know, you don't need me to point that out, though. But yeah, but then also, so he's in it. He did the music video. And then also in the thing, like you said before, they refer to him as God. So this is like, this movie has full reverence for Lemmy. I noticed, too, watching it back and speaking about the level of Michael Lehman, the director, there's an attention to detail in the movie that I think, again, it's like a comedy, so you think it's kind of an armpit fart of a movie, but it's like, no, this is like really cool. I noticed, I think I pointed out that when the first scene, Brendan Fraser gets kicked out of the record company for trying to break it and show people his demo, and we see pictures of Lemmy and Eddie Van Halen right next to each other on the wall. And then later, when they try to suss out if the guy's really from the record company or if he's a cop, they ask him questions about Lemmy and Van Halen. It's just a really neat little detail. I'm watching this movie 20-some years later, and I never noticed that, you know? So I think that it has a rewatchability, too. And that helps when the music is also great. Like, it really all comes together in a really good way.
Like, we knew that we both of us had a lot of affection for this movie, and you know, there's part of it where you wonder if it's nostalgia. Maybe
exactly.
you revisit something, maybe it's not as good as you remember, or it's like, oh, this doesn't feel the same now. But so watching it recently, knowing that we were going to talk about it, with a more critical eye maybe than in years past.
Yeah.
It just totally holds up.
Yeah.
It moves. We're fucking 15 minutes into the movie. They're already in the radio station.
Mm-hmm.
That's a movie that moves.
Absolutely. And I do think you're right. I'm glad you said that, and you said it very well, because there's that worry anytime you, whether it's go back and watch something or just go to bat for something, like I show you a movie, a comedy that I grew up loving and you've never seen it. And then we're sitting on the couch and I'm going, you know, maybe Super Troopers is like too fucking long and not that funny after the first scene where they're fucking with the kids smoking pot. Just maybe I was just smoking a lot of pot and in high school and that movie hit me just perfectly.
Yeah.
Right. Maybe.
Maybe, watching this as a stoned high schooler is different than showing it to your wife in your 30s.
right. She's like, can we watch the new Martin Scorsese film? Well, it's my turn to pick. I used to watch Super Troopers with my buddies, you know. Yeah. Which is, it's just,
I almost thought you were gonna say what was that one that we watched and I just really did not fucking
was it
like
another it. One that I was like, this is super good, let's watch it.
Was,
oh no,
was it Diner? Is that it?
We watched Diner together for the first time, and I was underwhelmed as well. I thought I was gonna like it.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, this sounds like Clerks from a decade before or something.
Yeah.
And this isn't the Diner episode. That would be the other show we do, I think, of movies we don't necessarily click with their good movies.
Yeah, are critically acclaimed, but we just didn't fucking
that would like. Be the, see, that's like the more cynical version that I'm trying not to do, but right. There might be room one day. We'll make a list somewhere and
movies we're grumps about.
But no, but that said, it's like, man, the other thing, and we talked about the cast, but it's like, there's a bar there, and most people really kind of rise to it because somehow we haven't even mentioned that Chris Farley is in this movie, right?
I didn't mention him.
Maybe, I'm sure you did when you ran. I'm sorry, on the run through you did, but even just to circle back, because, like, you know, it ain't news that he's great. He steals everything he's in, and I noticed that this time, Alan Covert, and probably his first appearance in an Adam Sandler vehicle as a little cop role.
I would theorize it's the first time Adam Sandler got Alan Covert.
I think it's a great call. He's in like his second scene, I think, and I think Ernie Hudson's talking to him, and then Chris Farley just enters. and you're fucking laughing. Like, you know, we were literally laughing. He just comes in and like makes a face.
His hair's a little messy.
Is just reacting to everything.
He plays a cop in the movie.
He's got like a line and a half in that scene, and he's okay. And he just fucking just, it's so good. And like, so that was always clear that Chris Farley steals whatever he's in. And in these small scenes in movies in the 90s, like Wayne's World and this and stuff like that, just show up, steal the scene, go home, whatever. But like, we're at this point now, you know, we just watched like another Chris Farley documentary the other month after there was one like a couple of years ago on A&E. We watched the Vice one, and like, it's really the point of just like, man, like seeing footage of Chris Farley that you've never seen before feels like a fucking treasure, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's one of those things. So I almost want, you know, when people talk about Chris Farley, the said documentaries, they don't even cover Airheads. You know what I mean? Because I get it. SNL, leading man, all this stuff. But like in this like beloved comic that was died tragically young, it's, I don't want to say lost. People know about Airheads, but do you know what I mean? Like unsung, maybe like a bit of a, like some of his funniest, most memorable, you know, like, yeah.
It's pretty understated as far as his performances go.
Yes.
But even with that, he's like, you know, he delivers the fuck out of a line, and all of his facial expressions.
And those sort of like, he's just like real stiff in his police costume kind of thing, and very fish out of water going up to like the Whiskey a Go-Go and like the cool metal clubs and going to the White Zombie concert to look for people. And it's so good. And like, what occurred to me is at the end, I love the way he yells, "Holy shit," as people are running. It's just like, oh, I've heard Chris Farley a holy shnikes so many times. Your brain almost goes, whoa, it's like hearing like the uncensored version of a song you've never heard or something. We're going, oh, he's blasted out, holy shit. I kind of like that.
And he drops a good, great, grand, wonderful too.
Yeah, yeah.
Definitely comes up in other things.
Great, grand, wonderful.
I think one thing I really thought about when we were watching it and we're talking about the cast and where they were in their career is like an obvious thing that I had said earlier is, oh, you got a guy from Spinal Tap in there, Michael McKean, comedy royalty, rock and roll comedy royalty, you know. But with him and Judd Nelson, they're like, they're so funny and they're old enough to know. And also I think Judd Nelson, just as far as being like the cool rock and roll Bender character from The Breakfast Club. So you have these two guys, these roles from the 80s, and they're a decade older, smart enough to know, like, it's kind of funny and cool if we play like the yuppie assholes that maybe get it less and maybe have sold out a little bit or whatever. And the more I watch the movie, it's just like, those are kind of harder characters maybe to get into when you're younger, right? Because like, they're sort of like thorns in the side. They're the Janis Soprano of it or something, where you're just like, oh, fuck you. And then you circle back and go, oh, they're great. They're actually really great.
It's like how when I was a kid, I really hated Chris Jericho. Chris Jericho is my favorite.
He's the best in the world, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Right, absolutely. And like, I just think, and the thing, is this a coincidence? Here's a little thing. We just stumbled upon this, I think, talking before we recorded today. I don't know if this is intentional or not, but maybe because the levels of detail in this movie, there's a great scene where Michael McKean protests because he doesn't want to sit on the floor. He really would like to sit in a chair, and it's not fair that if she gets to sit in a chair, I should be able to sit in a chair. And then they say, everyone get a chair but you. And then towards the end of the movie, he's tied to a chair. He cannot escape the chair.
He's the only one bound to a chair.
It's Shakespearean. I don't know, that might be a little much, but no. There's a part where they're going to throw him in the closet because he's tied up, and they just don't want to deal with him, I think, or they want to, you know, leave him somewhere. And he starts panicking, and he says,
oh, please, no. No, don't do this. I can't take it, man. My aunt was buried alive.
Love it. I have to believe on top of a good script, I have to believe there was some level of improvisation when you have guys from Spinal Tap like that. So
yeah.
Wonderful. Yeah.
And an interesting thing now, like I said, because on paper it might read like, oh, a 90s movie with all of these people in it. It was probably like at the very least like a big hit
something. A blip.
But apparently the people at Fox were resistant. Michael Lehman is on record of saying that they were resistant to the idea of casting Adam Sandler and Steve Buscemi and Joe Mantegna. Adam Sandler, he was unproven in movies, and the executives thought that his style of comedy being a little bit like more juvenile from what they had seen, they just weren't sure about him. And then with Steve Buscemi, they weren't sure if he could do comedy, and Michael Lehman said they were kind of afraid of him. I think just because
he was like Reservoir Dogs. He's probably super. They think he's the intense,
right,
gecko-eyed man.
Can he do comedy?
Wielding guns and yeah.
And that's sort of what the reaction to Joe Mantegna was too. Just he's
like a
serious
theatrical
actor.
Guy. He's like a theatrical David Mamet, like. Yeah, yeah. And he's great in that shit, but also, like, he's great as Fat Tony. He's great as Ian the Shark, the DJ. We were talking about it a little bit. It'd been easier to make him a certain kind of character, but he made him, or they made him, a very specific guy that is like wearing Hawaiian shirts and drinking Pepto-Bismol and shit, like, you know, and is kind of rock and roll, but he's not like the full-blown yuppie sellout guy. Mm-hmm. He's not still in the scene guy. He sort of isn't into emceeing the Sons of Thunder show at the beginning, right? He really creates something. I think that's what all these people do. The Michael McKeans and Chris Farley's just like bring so much to like the 10th biggest role in the movie or something, right?
Yeah.
Oh, I love it.
So the sort of maybe the inciting incident is the movie opens with Brendan Fraser's Chaz. He goes to the record label, tries to show Jimmy Wing, played by Judd Nelson, his demo, and get kicked off the lot because he's not supposed to be there. And then they go to some concert on the strip featuring the Sons of Thunder. But kind of a funny tidbit. It's funny that Chris Jericho came up. Because I thought that the lead singer of the Sons of Thunder, when I first saw that movie in the 90s, I think I asked my brother, is that Chris Jericho? Because I know he's in a band. Yeah. It looks like him. It kind of sounds like him. It's not, but I know that now. And every time I watch that movie, I just think about it.
I could definitely see. We're huge wrestling fans, by the way. That's going to come up.
Sorry
or whatever. Yeah. I could definitely see Chris Jericho like saying some shit and say, is this thing on? Like the way that he does that. You know, Mike, it was very funny. Very funny bit.
So anyway, the Sons of Thunder are playing this song. They're playing this concert, and they say they thank Ian the Shark for playing their song on the radio and basically getting them signed. So then, you know, Chaz drinking a beer comes up with an idea. Nods like, okay, I know what to do here. We got to play our song on the radio.
Do you think he does a great job with that bottle of beer?
Completely.
He really fucking does, man. I'm glad you think that. Yeah. If you want to, it's just like, again, the little touches that connect.
Watch his beer bottle work in this. It's really good.
You think we're kidding around, but like, you're like, wow, okay. That thing's almost gone. It's really good. And you know what? He's going to have another. Yeah. I can tell, by the way, mm-hmm. that he's drinking that one. Not his first, not his last of the night.
But he's getting every drop of it because, you know, he's broke. Times are tough. He got kicked out of his fucking house again, or his apartment.
Maybe I'd like to think Rex bought him a beer. You know, we did point out that when we were watching it, that Rex and Pip, Buscemi and Stanley, who are brothers, I don't know if we pointed that out yet, have jobs, are gainfully employed. And mm-hmm. pretty nice that they take their friend on. They really feel like loyal, not just actual brothers, but like brothers, you know?
Yeah, instantly. When we get the impression that Chaz is kicked out of his apartment a lot by his girlfriend, who's like a... You know.
You keep kicking me out. It makes me insane or something. He says, yeah, that's right.
But so Rex works at a toy store. Pip has his pool cleaning service. And when Chaz tells the two of them that, or he goes to Rex and says, I got kicked out again. I need to crash with you guys. Pip's reaction is, oh, fuck. We can rock it after breakfast.
Yeah, it's such a Pip place.
Really wholesome.
Exactly. Yeah, wholesome.
They're good friends.
His first reaction is, we'll wake up, we'll eat breakfast, we'll just start fucking rocking. It's so sweet.
Hey, Chaz, what's up?
He's moving in with us for a while.
Get out of here, man. That's great. We can rock out after breakfast.
The movie wouldn't work if you didn't like the characters.
Yeah.
I mean, it helps that you know that they're not actually holding people hostage with weapons.
I was going to talk about that. That's a really, I think, a really... intelligent thing. You found a thing before, I don't think you've said it on here yet, that the screenwriter was a bit inspired by Dog Day Afternoon. Like, there's a way to twist this and make it for laughs. This scenario is here. And the biggest thing is, it's like a huge plot point. There's hot sauce in the guns, but the most intelligent thing is of that is, like, I guess so much of the comedy here, maybe a lot of comedy in general, is just like, who knows what, right? Like, it's really funny if a character thinks they're right, but they're wrong, and they're speaking with a lot of bravado and confidence in their own. Like, that's so funny sometimes. This is just like, you're able to laugh. These people, like, you know, they're all safe. They don't know that there's not gun wielding maniacs in here. You know what I mean? So it just like exists on this level of, you know, as much as they do and stuff like that. And then by the end, the people outside of the standoff don't know that like half these hostages are in cahoots with them by now. It's half buddies and girlfriends by the end of the thing. You know what I mean? They kind of just all. Yeah. But yeah, so I like that, how it sort of flips around, like who knows what and everything else. And I was going to say too, I love the script's version of just like, you could tell there's just like, they have this resentment for everything that they think sucks about music. And it's personified by like the costumes that the band is wearing in the record company at the beginning. They're wearing big Dr. Seuss hats. And then like the Sons of Thunder are wearing their ridiculous get-ups on stage.
Look at them pantaloons they're wearing.
Yeah. And so it makes you, and then you see these guys like, oh man, they're just real guys cleaning pools, mm-hmm. fighting with their girlfriends. Mm-hmm. It all works. Oh, it works. I love it.
In them stupid pantaloons they're wearing.
That's what we gotta do. Well, it looks like they're carrying a load in them pants.
You know, they play their song on the radio and they got an album and everything. That's what we got to do.
Oh, this is, I don't know if this is relevant to anything. I just liked this little tidbit.
Mm-hmm.
The Sons of Thunder are portrayed by a real band.
Oh.
That band, the Galactic Cowboys.
Okay, all right, the Galactic Cowboys.
I see why they changed it, because that's a far cooler name than the Sons of Thunder.
Sons of Thunder.
Galactic Cowboys.
Galactic Cowboys. They both sound a little made up, but like in that fun way, I guess. Like one is and one isn't, right? So yeah, that's pretty great. I think too, I like their relationship with Ian the Shark a lot. The Joe Mantegna, the radio DJ, who by the end they've brought some rock and roll back out of him as he finds out that throughout the movie, you know, he gets angered about some things, and they pull some of the youngster back out of him. But I love how they think they're like friends, like from the start. Like I laughed a lot about the part in the movie about halfway through where they're having trouble with their demo tape. They're in a standoff. Ian completely just tries to say, "Hey guys, you're boned. You like, what's your next move here?"
"No, there's cops outside with guns, and you're holding people hostage, right?"
Yeah.
And on top of that, your tape is destroyed. So there's only one thing that you can do.
Get the other copy of the demo."
Rex!
I just love that. It's like, again, who knows what or whatever. It's like, here's two guys coming at each other, just two completely T-bone each other. Just completely different understandings of what just happened.
That's classic comedy, right?
Right. And then with that, we can't play it on the clip, but like Brendan, his face, he lights up. Oh, I know exactly what you're talking about. And he couldn't be. Yeah, it's so good.
And it's interesting. It's like, it's the first time Brendan Fraser was a leading man, and he does so well. Like, it's his performance is so good. He's so good.
Yeah.
I'm so happy that he's out and working again, because he's really like fun to watch.
You know, and that's what I was saying, where it's like, you know, Buscemi has become adored, you know, rightfully so. I liked him through his work in the 90s, just in like every other cool indie movie you'd watched. And then he spent like a decade conquering television, you know, and he's just...
Is this a good time to talk about how much we love Living in Oblivion?
This would be a great time to talk about Living in Oblivion. I think it came out a year later, I want to say. We're not going to get
95, right?
I doubt we're going to get to talk about it.
It did too well.
Yeah, exactly. By way of bad reviews, because honestly, and while you're looking at it, I'll tell super quick. I was going to mention this too, just like being aware of critic consensus and stuff like that. I want to just say again, it's not that I really am like, oh, got bad reviews, but I think being into movies, certainly at a young age, I would just read, like, I had a subscription to Entertainment Weekly at a freakishly young age. So I was just always aware of how movies were performing and grossing and reading the reviews, but I still like went to see them and stuff like that, right? So my point just being, so that's a little bit why I even halfway, I care about this because it got jammed into my brain or whatever. But the other thing being, I was made aware of Living in Oblivion because I think it was Entertainment Weekly's film of the year in 1995. And I, as an 11-year-old, was like, this sounds like a biting satire of the independent movie scene. Mom, I want to see the satire.
Yeah, Living in Oblivion rules. It's so good.
It's perfect.
It did well critically. Everybody that I know that has seen it likes it.
Yes.
But I just don't know that many people that have
seen it. It just didn't endure the way some movies endure, right? Whether it's...
To be fair, it's not... I don't think it's like on any streaming platforms except for maybe Canopy.
That's kind of that helps so much these days. There's certain movies, we've talked about this, it'll come up again certainly as we recommend movies that may or may not be on your streaming platforms. We have to be careful because some movies you never see, and some movies are just stuck in this bingo drum do-si-do that I swear they just turn it around and go, okay, Demolition Man's going to be on Hulu for 3 months and Amazon Prime for 1 month of Venn diagram overlap, and then a year on Prime. You know, it just, like, it's maddening. But also with that, there's movies that aren't in the drum at all. Or no, the drum was this. Yeah, whatever.
Living in Oblivion, the new film by Tom DiCillo.
You know, the only reason I took a part in this movie is because someone said that you were tight with Quentin Tarantino.
So yeah, just to kind of really recommend the movie, like if you're not familiar with it, I think it, you're gonna have a hard time finding it. I know that you guys are smart, you can find fucking movies, so just keep an eye out for Living in Oblivion. I think part of the thing is, like, it was a pretty small movie. I see here they had a budget of $500,000.
Yeah.
Which for 95 is
pretty
small.
It's another one that it's a lot of people, it's like Peter Dinklage and Catherine Keener, people whose stars have risen since. And like, if that exact same movie had never been made, but they made it today, it'd be like,
yeah,
it'd be a thing. You know?
It's super, super good.
Hilarious. It does really, I would hate to give some of the fun of it away, but it just like, it goes places, like it keeps you on your toes. And, It's hilarious. It really is like no other movie I've seen, I think I could say, when I think back to the way it's structured.
Yeah.
And just the way, what you, yeah. I hate being vague about something I'm gushing about, but it's so, yeah. Living in Oblivion. Must see it. And another recommendation, you mentioned it. If you're movie folks, see if you can get involved with Canopy. It's a streaming service that mm-hmm. you can sync up with your library card.
Or like if you have like a student email.
Or student stuff. Cool. And it's kind of this almost alternative access streaming things. They give you X amount of streams in a month, but it's similar to like more Criterion and, you know, like prestigious stuff, dare I say, right? On a whole. And independent.
Generally, but I think it's like anything else.
You find other stuff. Okay. You find some.
Yeah. So just check it out.
But it's where you'd find, I think, like Living in Oblivion, for example. It's a nice little home for things like that.
Yeah. If it has a good Letterboxd score, it's probably on Canopy.
That's right.
So at one point in the movie, we're on the Sunset Strip, we're at a music venue, and we see White Zombie give a brief
they're playing a song.
They play a fucking song.
They're at a concert.
But there had been other bands that the filmmakers approached first, and it was almost Cannibal Corpse, but they ultimately did not take it because they had already filmed their bit for Ace Ventura, Pet Detective.
Now, that's the best thing. I didn't know that until you found that today. I love that so much. And this is when we say, okay, are we just, maybe we're just rose-colored glasses? Like, are we rose-colored glasses for the 90s? Or were the 90s just so rad that Cannibal Corpse were getting double booked for mainstream comedy movies? Maybe that's what's going on. We were just lucky to be at a good age to take it in, you know? That's what I maintain. That's fucking so cool. And, you know, Cannibal Corpse would have been good for what they're going for, because it's like probably more extreme than White Zombie, you know? And it's like when Chris Farley is like, you know, oh, he's in with all these big burly metal dudes and stuff. But like the White Zombie song is pretty cool. I'm kind of happy with how it worked out. Cool little, like I said, a little time capsule. He's not Rob Zombie yet. He's White Zombie. Right? The differences are negligible, but, you know.
Still got that hair.
You got the hair. The sound, kind of over it. Yeah.
But even just some of the other cameos in the movie. We already mentioned Lemmy, Beavis and Butthead.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny because they sort of make a lot. They make a lot of fun. They take a lot of jabs at MTV. And things
certainly,
like that.
Certainly.
So to get Beavis and Butthead, and we see Kurt Loder. Kurt Loder
That's
cameo.
Right. And he does a callback to one of the better jokes in the movie.
Yeah.
And it's so fun. Yeah.
Okay, in just a few moments now, we're going to be witnessing the culmination of this extraordinary rock and roll drama, a live performance by the Lone Rangers. Wait a minute. Cut it. That can't be right, can I? You can't pluralize Lone Ranger.
And we also see for the Howard Stern show heads, we see Stuttering John.
Stuttering John Menendez, whose novelty song, I think, by way of like, he wasn't an artist that made albums and songs, but he had a song called I'll Talk My Way Out of It, which I remember got played on the radio at the time. It was an alternative single. Much like the, so that CD was so great, man, because it was like cool, cool shit. Like, you know, you had your, like the aforementioned, the cool White Zombie song, Motorhead, the Ramones, great Ramones song at the end. Perfect Ramones song at the end for the movie and stuff. And then, also like in a good way, novelty songs, like I'll Talk My Way Out of It and, Degenerated by the Lone Ranger. You know what I mean? Like they really offered a lot for like one album. I really loved it. And that's interesting too, because to get a guy, a personality from the Howard Stern show at this point in 1994, Howard Stern, Beavis and Butthead, these were like big, you know, gets or whatever. And I mean, Stuttering John's not exactly, it's not like they had Howard Stern himself. I realize that, you know what I mean? But it's just fun. It's a movie that you never quite know what's going to happen. And with that, it occurred to me that with this cast, there's so many, like, they didn't leave a lot on the table, it feels like. You get fun pairings of all of them. Adam Sandler gets a fun scene with this guy and this guy. You know, David Arquette gets this funny scene. And just, you know what I mean? Like, they bounce off each other in all the fun ways. Like, I love, of course, David Arquette's dynamic with everybody is great. Adam Sandler just talking to any of the black characters is a treat.
Why don't black people like me?
Excuse me?
Just, you know, I listen to a lot of rap music. And I know how angry black people are. And I feel bad, you know, for all you guys got to put up with.
Well, that's very nice of you.
How about when you going to a store and all the clerks start staring at you like you're going to rob the place and you're like, hey, I just want to buy something.
I'm sorry, that's never happened to me. Does that happen to you?
Huh? No. But just saying, now it would be bad if it did. Look at Chaz out there doing his thing.
And Ernie Hudson, he's just so good as... He's typecast as cops, I think, because he's just really good at it. Like, I recently rewatched Miss Congeniality. Mm-hmm. And he's really good as the... whatever you fucking call FBI bosses.
Yeah, yeah. He's a comforting face to see in a movie, Ernie mm-hmm. Hudson. You know, he's just in good hands. And like,
yeah, and it's funny that he's always like the uptight cop boss because he's like the most laid back Ghostbuster.
That's true.
Smoking
That's true.
And
yeah.
Talking about Twinkies.
I like, I think we mentioned like the Die Hard stuff a little bit. There's also like Die Hard elements in the sense of there's like a little bit of, he's kind of the cop, the Family Matters guy character from Die Hard, who's like, you know, more hot-headed cops come in outside. And he's like, come on, we don't have to be so fucking crazy here, do we? And there's shots where that's happening in, like, the towers in the background. Like, this is clearly a little nod to Die Hard because they're not on the 20th floor of the radio station. I think it's all the ground floor, but suddenly the tower is very prominent when the cops are fighting about, like, what to do, you know? Like, I like that it's got, it's aware of rock and roll and Die Hard, and so it's like kind of what's going on in music and movies all at once. And it's like people that just think it's some dumb comedy might be like think it's laughable that I find it this, you know, we find it this not just enjoyable, but like there's a lot going on here. It's well crafted. It's not just like, oh, I like the lowbrow slapstick jokes or whatever, you know. I like the way that the movie really has its own kind of like language, the way the guys insult people and stuff. They say really weird things.
I mean, you look like half a butt puppet.
Yeah. You treat me like I'm some necklace goober or something, you know. And then there's a great thing where I feel like it's Michael McKean trying to do that. And he says, I know you think I'm a real dick cheese burger, whatever. Yeah. Would this be an okay part to just say one or two more lines that we like a lot?
Yeah.
I love towards the end when like, I guess tensions are getting high. They're kind of sitting around and waiting for the big finale, we'll say. Pip, Adam Sandler, the drummer, is telling some of the folks about his big grand vision.
I want to get a drum set that goes underwater so in the middle of our show they can dunk me in a tank and I can do my solo.
Cool!
And we just love it. I think I've been kind of throwing to you and maybe you to me sometimes too. If I just say something, it's kind of because I know you'll say,
cool! We've been saying that to each other for
like when we met
close to a decade.
Like, yeah, exactly. Like we figured out early on that we like a lot of the same things, and among them it was like Goodfellas, Airheads, and a handful of others and stuff like that. And then yeah, the cool came right along. We also often accuse each other of being all woohoo and shit, mm-hmm. which is a great. It's almost like a great underwritten line, I guess. They didn't give David Arquette's character this like eloquent thing to say. He's like, "You guys are woohoo and shit." Like, I love it.
There's also another thing that we say to each other a lot.
There's so many that I'm forgetting, apparently. Or, I mean, there's so many that I'm forgetting some.
At the beginning, toward the beginning of the movie, Chaz is home. He's just, like, fucking off on the couch, watching music videos. Oh, his girlfriend comes home from work, and he basically asks, like, hey, how are you? How was your day? Whatever. And she says,
Barry is a tremendous asshole. He had this whole stack of invoices, and he made me arrange them by date. He's such a tweaker.
Sucks.
He says it. Like, you can just tell he didn't listen to a fucking word she said.
Yeah. And it's a thing where I don't think it's bad writing, but it's just one word. You know what I mean? Like, on the page, it sucks. You know, I like, again, much like drinking a beer bottle. Brendan Fraser, like, he steps up to the plate. He's like, I get you get the one word, huh? All right. I can do, you know, I can perform this and mm-hmm. show you who this guy is a little bit, certainly in this moment. And then a second later, too, to continue that, she's talking some more. And he's watching, it's the Janie's Got a Gun music video by Aerosmith. And he's playing the guitar solo. And while she's talking, he goes, ow! And he's air guitaring on the remote. I was just describing the movie at this point. If you're just tuning in. Yeah, it's great. All the little moments, the details are great.
What we're getting at is, it's a good movie.
It's a really good movie.
We really like it. I think it holds up super well.
Respects your time, like you were saying, how it moves.
I don't, right, like just the pacing of it alone, it's like maybe 90 minutes. Like,
I think 94, I want to say, I noticed. But that's with good music, so you have a little extended opening and things. You know what I mean? I think it's.
I don't understand why critics shit on it as much as they did, especially know. I really don't.
I think we're gonna see. It's just comedies are just tough. And
There's a lot of genre stuff. People like critics just don't know how to respond to genres.
I really just feel like genre stuff where I just feel like we all might engage with a dramatic movie for maybe more similar reasons than, like, I don't know. Like, I'm a kid. I'm an Adam Sandler fan. I'm gonna smoke weed. I just worked all day or something. You know what I mean? Like, the things that lead up to me watching a comedy movie just feel different. And again, I know some movies, comedies do get good reviews. It's not like it's impossible, but I just think it's just like a tougher sell for some reason. And we talk about it, even if a movie's critically acclaimed as a comedy, it's rarely going to be in the conversation for awards. And again, who gives a shit? But just saying, like, that's just the thing. So it's just, I think it's fun. And I like that we're on the same page with this stuff where, like, I just think it's more fun. It's more interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like we are kind of the opposite of a tough watch.
Yeah, man. I'm an easy watch. Yeah. I think same, like, we're both big video game players, and I'm sure that'll come up from time to time too. But I think, like, I'm just aware of how much effort goes into them. And so I think people easily dismiss them. If that's your style, fine. You can't help your gut reaction to things maybe. But if a movie, like, I don't know, people just write off an entire movie, and I get it. If it's overall more bad than good, so be it. But I just think there's acting, there's writing, there's cinematography, there's so on and so on and so on and stuff. I think there's yeah, like you said, we're an easy crowd.
So if that might, you know, there's just this thing that happens with critics or even people that just like to write about movies or make content about movies, where I think they just conflate this thing where in order to have something to say about it, you have to be really critical of it. You have to kind of shit all over it.
Yeah.
It's people's first instinct for some reason is to shit on something. That's just not our bag, man.
Right.
Where
I feel like even to speak, there's a lot of different ways people evaluate movies. We're doing this Rotten Tomatoes. We're looking at this percentage thing, but the aforementioned, like, I grew up reading reviews from Entertainment Weekly that would do a letter grade, which plenty of other things do letter grades.
It's so funny that you had an Entertainment Weekly subscription
fucking
as a kid.
Dork, babe. Sports Illustrated too. I read two magazines a week. I was 10.
I think I had J14.
Yeah, I think I had a Disney Adventures as well, but I think I outgrew that.
I don't even know what that one is.
It was just like, you know, we interviewed the bear from Tailspin or something. I don't know. You know, little kid shit. Yeah. Nothing at all like fall movie preview issues that I would devour.
But even as somebody that's been exposed to critics and
just reading it, you know, well, what I was going to say was it always just bothered me the approach of criticism in general is we're like, so if you see a movie and want to give it a B+, that's pretty good, right? That's like a pretty good, you did more. It still is like, but here's the reasons it's not an A or an A-. So like the cynicism works its way into good reviews even. And I just feel like sometimes I think about like, what if you like met the director of this movie and said, hey man, I really liked your movie. Like, really? Because I read all the reasons you thought it, you know what I mean? It just seems like you're like taking little pot shots, and I get it. You're justifying your B+, but I just like, I don't have to shit letter grade. I don't have to focus on the parts I don't like. If I think the sum is far greater than the parts, or the good far always the bad. Yeah, but there's, I don't know, you know?
We had talked about that in preparation for, you know, making this show. It's like, we're not graders. We don't like to assign a letter grade or number rating just because, like, how do you even define what's a 7, what's an 8? It's just too complicated. Mm-hmm. So I think that it's just going to be easy on us if we ask, so is this worth watching?
Yeah.
Is this movie worth watching?
I'd say,
you know, I think you could probably guess.
Yeah, it's worth watching. Yeah. Good as hell. To the extent I would say this, if you've never seen it, thank you for making it this far. If you have seen it, thank you for making it this far. But no, if you've not seen it, please watch it. Even if you've seen it and you're like, oh, cool, I'll check out the show, hear what they think, I haven't thought about it in a while. Maybe you feel like you just watched it, in which case I understand. But like I said, it holds up. Like I said, there's fun things to notice. There's attention to detail, and there's small moments and supporting performances. And you know what I mean? Like every small character, again, most of them had absolute ringers for actors. And they're just feel like they don't, if you add up how much time they're on screen, it might be surprising, right? How much an impact someone like Harold Ramis leaves and is in the movie for like a minute, right? Mm-hmm. Or even Chris Farley, probably about 5 minutes, if that, or something, if you were to add it all up. But yeah, top to bottom, outstanding, good as hell. And then
they got this one wrong.
I think they got it wrong, man. I think they got it wrong. What was it again? 28%?
29%.
So yeah, you know, 100% over here at this table. The dog in your hands is sleeping, so he doesn't get a vote.
Yeah, you know, even just cruising like the negative reviews just to get a sense for what people didn't like. It's like calling it cringy or slow paced or like, I can't disagree more.
Yeah.
I really, maybe I'm just old and out of touch, but I don't understand the hate.
Right. And as I age, it's like, if anything, you think you might age out of what is kind of a broad comedy, right? About in a lot of ways, not exclusively, nice, but it's a sort of movie you could see being like, I liked that more when I was younger, but I watch it more and I appreciate the writing of it as I've become a comedy writer and an aspiring screenwriter. It's like, man, the script is like, every little thing is early set, like, you know, it's either a joke or it's a nice little piece of information that you don't realize they're giving you. But even something is like, oh, casually putting pepper sauce in the gun, and then later you know that what's going on with they don't have to remind you or anything. It's all just been very, you don't realize when he's shooting Stretch Armstrong in the face with hot sauce that it's like, oh, this is pivotal, or like, this is information they're giving me as a viewer to know what's continue, you know what I mean, like all that stuff. And just like the we're also the everyone feels like they're in the middle of something. They also happen to do this at a time that the radio station KPPX Rebel Radio, what's it doing, babe?
It's going soft.
Rebel Radio's going soft. So I think that's intriguing too, that there's actually kind of this subplot, like they were going to have Ian and I forget Michael McKean's name in the movie, but they
Milo.
Milo. How can I forget? They were probably going to fight that day anyway, right? Or someday very soon.
Yeah.
So it just feels like, I think maybe a lot of comedies, characters walk in to say their funny stuff and leave, but this is like a very thought out world that the movie takes place in, you know?
Yeah. There's nothing extraneous, and it just moves, and it's got a really good soundtrack.
Yeah,
nothing to not like, I don't think.
Yeah, no, I think that might be all we have to say on that. Dare I say? Don't let me stop you.
Oh, I sure think so.
Cool.
Thank you guys for listening, and you can follow us on all of the things. Mm-hmm. I'm on Twitter at tapeabe_.
And I'm Mark Roebuck, MarkRoebuck at Twitter as well. Yeah, we're also...
If you found this, you probably know that already.
I've always thought, yeah. It was just like, at the end of the show, it's like, whatever you did, keep doing it.
Keep doing it.
Thanks. Do it again. Maybe subscribe.
Subscribe. Leave a nice review.
Yeah.
I'm told that helps. I don't know why.
It just helps. I think I've heard they're better than bad reviews. And
hey. Without bad reviews, we wouldn't have them.
That's the thing, man. We have a whole thing here. Our whole thing is about bad reviews don't matter, so we're kind of review proof. No, I don't want to provoke anyone. No.
Nope.
Leave a good review. We'd appreciate
it. Be nice to us, please.
That too, guys. We stay inside.
I don't want to go to jail. I'm fragile.
Thanks, everybody.
My throat.